Europe acknowledges the traditional owners of the land this podcast was recorded on. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and extend this to all First Nations people. Hello, and welcome to Arup's podcast, Sustainable Forces, a podcast about people joining forces for the planet. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Dickinson, an engineer bringing stories of sustainable development to you. Today's big question is, how do you partner to leave a legacy? And to discuss it, I was joined by Louise Heron, who is Sydney Opera House's CEO, and Tristram Carfrae, Arup's Global Deputy Chair. The Sydney Opera House is one of the world's most recognisable landmarks, and this year it's celebrating a big birthday as the iconic building turns 50. Known as the People's House, it's a welcoming space for people to gather and tell stories. With over 10 million visitors annually, it's also been valued at 11.4 billion Australian dollars in social value. I was actually in Sydney on the day that the Opera House turned 50 and was lucky enough to experience some of the birthday celebrations. And as I watched thousands of strangers gathering to celebrate this incredible structure, it got me thinking about what it must take to create and maintain a legacy like the Sydney Opera House. The Opera House has worked with many partners over its lifetime, including Arup, which was a partner from the very start. In this episode, we are going to explore the enduring relationship between the Sydney Opera House and Arup, which started way back in the 1950s and continues on to today. We will also discover how partnerships can help to achieve a vision and to leave a legacy. And we'll find out what the future generation will have to look forward to when they visit the building. Here's my chat with Tristram and Louise. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Louise, thank you so much for joining us today and congratulations on the Sydney Opera House's 50th anniversary. What an exciting year it must be. I was really lucky. I was in Sydney for the 50th birthday celebration and the whole building was lit up with the most incredible laser light show. What's been your highlight during this big celebration?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me, Michelle. And Tristram, I'm really thrilled to be here because Arup has been such an essential part of the Opera House going back way more than 50 years to, in fact, it's 69 years since Joe Carl announced that he would build an Opera House. And it's coming up for 66 years that Arup has been involved in building the Opera House. So yes, it's 50 years since opening, but actually the connection of Arup to the Opera House is far longer than that. To answer your question, to me, the most wonderful thing about the 50th anniversary has been reminding ourselves of how much people care about the Opera House, what it means to every single person, whether they come here or not. I mean, we had an open day, 28,000 people came to, and people queued up in the sun. There were dinosaurs and bin chickens and things and seagulls to amuse them, but they didn't mind waiting for 2 hours to come inside. And we had over 100 staff volunteered to help show people around the building. There were performances in every space. And these are people who don't normally come to the Opera House, and that it is just such a wonderful reminder of the importance of the Opera House for the people who come here often, but very importantly for the people who don't.
So much. And talking about people who don't, Tristram, where are you joining us from right now?
No, hi, Michelle. Hi, Louise. Also, really pleased to be with you today. No, I am in Amersham, just outside London. I'm at the very end of the London Tube Line. In zone 9, most people have no idea there is a zone 9. And I've been also sort of really enjoying the celebration, you know, vicariously, unfortunately, but with great sense of pride. I mean, this is the project that made Arup the firm that I have now worked for the last 42 years for all my professional life. And I've been also been asked and have, you know, spoken on the BBC World Service, made a video for Mashable, contributed an op-ed to the Australian Design Review, And there's a French architectural magazine called Architecture d'Aujourd'hui, who've dedicated a whole issue just to the construction of the Opera House, for which I was fortunate and grateful to write a foreword. So I feel as I've been part of it all, but from a great distance, Michelle.
You didn't have a little celebration party in London by yourself?
No, I didn't, unfortunately. I'm going to say later, I'll tell you later, I hope, you know, all the reasons why the Opera House is so important to me personally, as well as to Arup. And I also missed the great celebrations that were happening at the Institution of Civil Engineers. So the Great Hall of the Institution of Civil Engineers held a grand reception in honour of the Opera House a few weeks ago. But unfortunately, I was on holiday in Venice with my brother-in-law, so can't win them all.
It's a terrible life. Well, then let's move to the big theme of this podcast. We always talk about the power of partnership, but today it's actually going to be our specific focus. And we're going to think about how partnership can leave a positive legacy for our environment, for our society, and for our people. Tristram, I know that Arup's partnership with the Sydney Opera House started way, way back in the 1950s. Can you share a little bit about how that story started and where that partnership is today?
Sure. So this 1957 international competition held by the New South Wales government for the design of a new opera house was won by a little known Danish architect by the name of Jørn Utzon with a brilliant, as was described, as a sketch, if you like, an idea, a germ of an idea. And Ove Arup, who was a Dane with an engineering practice in London, when he heard the news, immediately reached out and said, "We can help you. We know all about concrete shells. I'm a Dane. I understand design. Couldn't we work together?" So that was the start of a partnership. But then our partnership continued with the succeeding architects, Hall, Todd and Littlemore, to design the interiors, including the main glass walls. And then after that, of course, we carried on working with the Sydney Opera House Trust up until this day, helping to keep the building relevant and to be the best opera house in the world.
Now, I get to travel a lot for my job, and I don't know, wherever I am in the world, if I talk about Australia, people say kangaroos, koalas, and the Sydney Opera House. It's probably one of the most famous buildings in the world. And it's inspired and strengthened communities. It's created homes for artists. It's welcomed audiences and visitors from across the globe. Like you said, Louise, 20-something thousand coming through. Louise, during your tenure as CEO, did you set a legacy that you wanted to achieve for the Sydney Opera House?
So when I start, I would say a vision more than a legacy, because I feel as if a legacy sounds like you're looking to sort of somehow give yourself a medal, and I don't really believe in that. So I wouldn't say that, but I would say that I definitely set out with an ambition, and that ambition was to renew the Opera House for future generations of artists, audiences and visitors. And as Tristram just mentioned, about making sure that the Opera House is always relevant. You know, being a building that at that time, at the 40th anniversary, so 10 years ago exactly, we announced we had been planning a little bit from when I started, just over 11 years ago, we had been planning this decade of renewal. We announced at the 40th anniversary that we had an aspiration because it hadn't been adequately maintained. There were, in all respects, and that wasn't due, that's nobody's fault. That's just, you know, it's a building in a marine environment with high technology changes and a lot of changes in performance and requirements of artists and also changes in what audiences want. And we wanted to make sure that we were as relevant to the audience in 2023 and beyond as we were in, you know, in 1973 when we opened. And look, it always started out as being the people's house, but it did slightly lose its way on that score. So renewing the Opera House for future generations is not just about renewing the building. It was also renewing the way we do things. And, you know, we don't want people to see the Opera House as a place where there's opera. Yes, there's opera. It's 10% of what we do. But there is so much more that we do And we really wanted to change people's perception of the Opera House and its relevance. And if I could just say something, just sort of going back, Michelle, to what you said about, you know, kangaroos and koalas and the Opera House. In fact, at the 40th anniversary, we commissioned Deloitte Access Economics to do a report of the social value of the Opera House, which did. And they valued it at $4.7 billion. That's quite apart from the $3 billion of the land and buildings value. Then we did a midpoint review at the 45th anniversary, and then we did a review for the 50th anniversary. And the value increased to $11.4 billion. So that means that over the decade of renewal, in real terms, that's once you take away inflation and methodology, the Opera House increased in value by 40%, or it's the social value. In other words, it is 40% more loved now than it was 10 years ago, both by people who come here and people who don't come here. And in terms of brand recognition, it is in fact recognized exactly as you say, koalas, kangaroos, and the Opera House are all equally recognized. In fact, the Opera House is slightly ahead of them. And the three adjectives that are used to describe that are most appropriate, this is from interviews from 4,000 people, both in Australia and internationally. The three adjectives that are most attributed to the Opera House are unique, which has always been the case, dynamic, and visionary. And both of those are new right up in the top. And so I guess it is fantastic to, at the 50th anniversary, to actually look back and say, when you have a really strong vision and you have the commitment and the backing of a vast array of stakeholders and partners, a partnership with Arup, who's been involved from the very beginning, you actually can achieve what you set out to do, which is to make Utzon's sketch, as Tristram said, real, and to keep it relevant and real.
Well, let's talk about keeping things relevant and real. I think anybody who's ever visited the Opera House has their own story of how it's affected them, how they felt around it. And one of my favorite things about this podcast is listening to stories that come from real examples on actual projects. When you have incredible people working in amazing organizations, there must be so many magical things happening behind the scenes. So, Louise, you recently completed a decade of renewal for the Opera House. As you talked about, there were technical things that you've done, but what's been your favorite project as part of this renewal and why?
You know, it's very hard to pick which project because we have, for example, removed all cars from the forecourt. So we've made it a beautiful civic space. We've done the waterproofing. I mean, I do love the technical projects like the waterproofing, which means that, you know, it's all fine and it's not going to leak into the car park. That's actually a very good thing. And we are, in Australia, extremely lucky to have these major projects well funded. The longer you leave maintenance, the more it costs and the more difficult it is. So we did that. We transformed the ticketing office and the legal office into the Centre for Creativity, and we're working very closely with the Over Arup Foundation on a brilliant project in that space. We created a new set of rooms from old catering offices called the Yalamundi Rooms, which means storytelling in the local language. Absolutely fantastic rooms with the best view in the world. We upgraded the Joan Sutherland Theatre and the box office foyers. But if I had to choose a favourite, I would say that the concert hall renewal is my favourite. And that is because after Utzon left in 1966 and was shortly thereafter replaced by Hall, Todd and Littlemore, and the use of the concert hall was changed. So it has a very high ceiling, 25 metres, and it has a very long hall, 45 metres. And when it was converted from a multi-purpose hall into a concert hall, essentially, you have this problem of this massive amount of space, which would have been used for the grid and the flight system, which is just actually surplus to requirements. And what does it do? It actually, all the sound travels up into the ceiling. So there's always been a problem with the acoustics, and we were really thrilled that as part of the decade of renewal, we were able to fix those acoustic problems as well as a lot of problems, with accessibility, for example. You know, there are steps everywhere, and how do you get, people with limited mobility into the opera house and into the concert hall in particular. The orchestra couldn't hear each other. It was just a very difficult hall, and it had always been a problem. So whereas the other things were just making better use of space and adapting them, this was actually completely renewing a World Heritage Hall. And then as part of the 50th anniversary celebrations, we invited the London Symphony Orchestra to come again. And Sir Simon Rattle had come with the orchestra before, just before we closed. And I said to him, you know, what do you think of the acoustics? And he said, not great. They're okay, but then I've heard worse, but I've heard far better. And on the night of the concert, of the first concert that the London, when he conducted the London Symphony Orchestra after the renewal of the concert hall, he turned around and he said, he addressed the audience after they went wild at the performance. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, you now have a concert hall that lives up to the promise of this building. An inside that matches the outside of the building. It is one of the finest concert halls in the world. And that's basically what we've heard from everybody who has been here. So not only, so it has been a tremendous success due to a massive amount of collaboration and, of course, involving Arab.
So good. And when you talk about the concert hall, I'm going to mention two things. One is an egg and one is an oyster. And I'm going to mention those because there's a little short film that's just come out from Arup. It's called House Proud. And it explains some of the complexities around this incredible aspect ratio that is the hall. So we'll send a link at the end of this podcast to watch this short film. It's incredible. And in it, there were so many different pockets of engineering excellence. So there's the digital mapping of the tile health, and then there's sneaking in an almost invisible glass elevator. I was captured by watching all the things that have happened over time. Tristan, I'm going to come to you. Can you tell us if you have a favorite project or a favorite story about how the Opera House has been shaped for the future?
Well, I'm going to start by commenting on the concert hall, because I think, you know, while it's wasted space, Louise, in some ways, or redundant space, you know, it also makes it a special place to be. It's different from any other concert hall, which are typically sort of shoebox arrangements in the acoustician's armory, if you like. And I think I recently heard a talk by our lead theatre consultant, who was saying, you know, what concert halls are now looking for is an oral signature. So they're actually all different, not all the same. And what you've got is this also, not, as well as now a wonderful acoustic space, you've got this visual signature, which is totally different to anybody else, while also sounding good, you know, which again is links it, I think, to the beauty of the building on the outside. So, but actually, Michelle, I was going to go back to the beginning. I've observed this on several projects, but I think no more than the Sydney Opera House, which is how a grand undertaking, if you like, a seemingly impossible commission, can lift people up and bring them to, you know, create things that they wouldn't have imagined possible. And I think the amount of engineering innovation as well as architectural beauty that went into the building initially, it's sometimes overlooked. But the use of digital computers for the design and analysis of a building for the first time, glued segmental construction is the technical term for the sails. But actually now, every big bridge in the world is made by that, using that technique, and it had not been used previously. Yeah. The use of laminated glass in the big walls, again, first time in a building, what became known as safety glass, you know, thereafter used in the automobile industry and elsewhere. And it all sort of represents, I think, the can-do attitude of the 60s, you know, and a belief in the future, you know, not being tied to the past, but looking forward, using new materials, new techniques and new things. And I can contrast that with one of my favourite stories, which I don't actually know whether it's true or not, but I love the idea whether it is or not, which is that Ian McKenzie, our resident engineer, who spent his many years, you know, going to site every day, sailed to work on his folk boat and moored up at Admiralty Steps every morning, stepped off his yacht, did his day's work, and then sailed home again. And I just think, you know, what an idyllic life, you know, sailing to work, creating this enormous, amazing building, and then sailing home again every evening. But the thing I remember from my time in Sydney, I think, was building a BIM model. So using computers again in the early 2000s to create a structure, a three-dimensional structure of the whole building. But what we managed to do with that is therefore to organise all the existing drawings, which of course were hand-drawn, and all the existing specifications, and put them into this three-dimensional database, if you like, so that from there on, all work on the Opera House could refer back to all the original drawings and construction details. So it became much easier to address, you know, things like the glass lift you just referred to.
Yeah, I've watched a few docos on, you know, the overspend of the initial Opera House and how some of these things that were never existed before, actually, probably if we did it today, people would say the budget says we can't. So I almost love how the building's legacy has come because they did push the frontiers that they weren't even expecting to push, I think, at the time. This can-do attitude, like you said, Tristram, it doesn't really exist as much anymore, I think. So it's really magical. We should probably go back to our power of partnership theme. Louise, look, it's been inspiring to hear about all these so many projects since you've come on that are going to transform you. I'm going to say legacy, but we can talk about the future of the building that you're going to leave. And there must have been so many steps that you took to get there. So let's talk a little bit about how partnership has helped you in some of these huge projects.
Well, I love what Tristram was just saying and what he said at the start about, you know, how this happened because three people, you know, because over Arab spoke. And also I do think it's important to acknowledge the role of Steens and Varming as well in this. You know, they were there and part of the partnership from the very beginning as well, and they are still very much part of, you know, our building services and building engineering to this day. But also to think about the fact of the partnership is very much about who is doing it and where it's happening. So when I first went to Denmark after I had started, this was in 2012, and I said to the Danes, thank you, and just think that we've got three Danes really working on this, right? We've got Utzon, Varming and Arup working on this building very closely. And I said to the Danes, those three being Danes, thank you so much for the Opera House. And they said, no, don't thank us. We should be thanking you. This never would have happened in Denmark. So what you talk about, Michelle, as an overspend was really about what would it take to realise the vision. And I guess that has been the spirit of partnership from the beginning. And that has been the thing, you know, working with, you know, working in partnership with the architecture community, with the heritage community, with the engineering community, with the sustainability community, with the government, you know, just working with multiple stakeholders. And I think that is the most important thing that I take away from this is how, yes, it's great to have a vision, but you have to take every single relevant person along with you on that, you know, on that path to success, because no one can achieve things alone. But what we can achieve together is tremendous. And, you know, Arup has been, from the outset, such a central part of that.
I love that you said taking relevant people or persons with us. That's really important, because when we talk about organizations partnering, what we actually mean is passionate people who are connecting with each other to create these long-term partnerships that thrive. Tristram, we're now seeing the next generation at Arup who are taking the lead to maintain this icon for the future. So what does this partnership mean to you, and what do you think it means for the next generation coming into this project at Arup?
Thanks, Michelle. So in a lot of ways, I'm the second generation, you know, in terms of Arup, at least. You know, I was actually born 2 weeks, I think, after the Opera House started construction. You know, so.
Oh, really? When were you born, Tristan? What's your birth date?
1st of April, 1959. I'm an April Fool.
Oh, you know what mine is?
No.
I was born a week before you. Mine's the 25th of March, 1959.
How about that? There you go. So we are obviously, neither of us, therefore, of the generation of the originals, I think, Louise, you refer to them as. You
exactly.
Know, the people who actually created this wonderful building in the first place. But I was mentored by some of the originals. So, in particular, Peter Rice, who spent 5 years in Australia and worked on the building beforehand. You know, Peter was my early mentor, and he taught me how to work with architects, how to care about architecture and about the whole project, not just, you know, our contribution as engineers to that building. And then when I arrived in Australia in 1986, I worked with John Nutt. John was also one of the original designers and then became the leader of our Australian practice. And he taught me how to be rigorous. It was no good having an idea if you couldn't deliver it. You had to send it all the way through. You had to make it real, you know, make it buildable, make it work. And then back in the UK again, our chairman of the day, Jack Zunz, who was, of course, the lead engineer for Arup on the sales of the Opera House in particular, he taught me to think broadly, to take everything into account, including the politics of the environment of the building in which you are doing things, which is, of course, is something he learned, you know, perhaps the hard way from the original creation of the Opera House. So for me, this is, you know, I'm a second generation, but it's been very much part of my professional life. But I'm now delighted to be passing on to the third generation, and particularly at a time when we have developed, I think, a very strong relationship with Louise and the Opera House Trust. You know, I think it's a high point. Again, you know, after 50 years, we're back at a high point in our relationship and our contribution. And I'm hoping that the new generation, which I also saw on that film, Michelle, you know, House Proud, I hope that they will continue this, you know, indefinitely. You know, as Louise didn't like the idea of leaving a legacy. And interestingly, one of the expressions used at Arup is leave Arup better than you found it, you know, which I've always rankled with me, because I think it should be make Arup better. You know, it's the positive actions you take today, not thinking about, you know, what's the future is. But I hope that view of taking positive actions will continue forever and ever and ever.
And you do have some absolutely outstanding people, but it's also about making sure that the relationships are excellent at all levels across the organisation. And I feel that is something that we have managed to work on really, really well together. And I just would like to comment for a moment, Michelle, on the multidisciplinarity and the fact that we realised that multidisciplinarity was, this was also 10 years ago, and when I was in Denmark, and I was sitting next to this fantastic guy called Kristen Obel, and we were talking about the Opera House and saying, you know, what would it take to make it happen again? And as you said, you know, that it is remarkable. And we said that the thing that is so unique about the Opera House is the fact that it was always a multidisciplinary project, exactly as Tristram said as well, that it's the combination of architects, engineers, and designers working together. And based on that realization, we set up the MAID program, the Multidisciplinary Australian-Danish Exchange, in partnership with Arup and Steensen Barming and others, under which we said over the next 10 years, so until we've just had the final of the 100 students, we missed a few due to COVID, but every year 5 Danish students, architects, engineers and designers would come to Sydney and work on a project, and every year 5 students, architects, engineers and designers from Australia would go to Denmark and work together on a project in the same multidisciplinary way. So they would have an outline of a project and they would work on something together. They would meet each other and 6 weeks later they would have to present their project. And honestly, the results of those projects were almost miraculous. And of the projects, Like if we had the money, we would love to build about half of those projects into the Opera House, because you just don't normally have that time to freewheel and dream. You think more about how do I fix the acoustics in the concert hall, or how do I make it more accessible? You think of straight line questions. But this idea that Trisha mentioned about thinking broadly, I guess that is the massive realization. It's the combination of the rigor and the broadness. And I guess that is what we have in common with Arup, is we know that that's how we have to approach things. But the MAID program was a tremendous success and another thing that we've done together. So we've done quite a lot of extracurricular things together to broaden the impact of the Opera House, I guess, on professionals and communities very broadly, and people's lives very broadly.
Yeah, and what you're talking about, Louise, is investing in the future generation. So having these relationships continue through that legacy of the Opera House. I think as we think about, you know, what future generations are thinking about when it comes to buildings, and you talked about the harsh environment that the Opera House was built in, and the waterproofing and the marine environment, it comes with its complexities. But I think that, you know, the next generation are so focused on a sustainable future and how we make sure that we're building sustainability into all of our infrastructure and our buildings. So Tristram, how do we ensure that this legacy and the legacy of some other buildings around the globe continues to grow while also thinking about, you know, efforts we need to safeguard the natural environment and thinking about sustainability?
So one aspect of sustainable development that isn't discussed very much is longevity. You know, so we talk about the costs of doing anything, you know, the costs in terms of material, in terms of carbon, you know, in terms of impact, et cetera. But on the other side are the benefits, you know, and the game, in my view, is to get the biggest possible benefit from the lowest possible cost, if I can put it like that. And in this case, you know, the big investment, the cost, was expended back in the 60s through to 1973. And now is the time to make sure we maximize the benefit we get from that cost. So it's again, I'm going back to what Louise was just talking about. It's about how do you keep the building relevant? How do you adapt it? How do you make it, you know, a thing for people? And I think the whole movement towards the People's House, towards bringing people from all parts of society into what would have traditionally have been seen as an elite and exclusive, you know, environment, but then using that platform of this wonderful space to then inspire people again to continue to lift themselves up and do better work. So I think Louise just talked about the MAID program, and I don't want to speak for her, but I think the ensuing BUILD program is just continuing that and taking it to another level where school children are coming into the Opera House and finding that platform allows them then to do things that they may not otherwise have imagined that they were capable of doing.
Totally. And I think the wonderful thing about the move from the MAID program to the BUILD program is that the BUILD program focuses very much on people from underrepresented communities, people who otherwise wouldn't come here. So we have a partnership with the University of Western Sydney, and rather than it being 10 students a year, it's more like 180 students a year who come in and have this brilliant time exploring the aspects of sustainability and thinking about the future of the Opera House, thinking that it's baked into its DNA, but how we can make the most of that for the future.
Not every building, I think, can be as iconic as the Opera House, to use a much overused word. But when you have one, when you have an icon, I think you've got to make the most of it.
And it sounds like you are. And is it correct that when they first built the building, they planned that it would last 200 years? But through your legacy projects, Louise, I think you're going to make it last for 2,000. Is that right?
No. We still have a few problems, you know. Still, like, bloody water, it does like to seep in underground. So we still have a few projects that we need to sort of secure before we... Yes, we design for 200 years. We always design for 200 years. I mean, not, you know, not technical equipment, but it is our ambition. But who knows? Will it still be functional in 2,000 years? I don't know about that.
Oh, look, I could talk to you two forever, but look, it's already been such an incredible conversation today. We always end this podcast giving tips to our listeners. So for anybody who's listening who may be thinking about partnering on a project or an initiative and they want to create legacy and positivity, I'm going to ask you for some guidance on how they might be able to do this. So do you have one piece of advice that you can share on creating amazing partnerships for a positive legacy? Louise, I'm going to start with you.
I'm going to say that the Tim Minchin song that we did for our 50th anniversary.
Which is brilliant.
Play it. It's brilliant, isn't it, Tristan?
Yeah.
Play it safe basically says it all. You can play it safe and stay at home and watch telly, or you can actually really think big. And that is my advice, to really always think big.
Amazing. And Tristram, do you have one that is a song maybe, or is it a song?
No, unfortunately, I have no songs. I can't match Louise. But I think it's about having a vision, you know, and getting people together at the beginning of a project, everybody, you know, clients, designers, you know, users, and say, what might be possible, you know? What could we achieve with this project? And then getting everybody motivated to try and achieve that vision or go beyond it even. And then it's about building trust between, to form a partnership, you have to have trust. And that trust comes from knowing each other, a relationship, and a common goal. So getting the common goal, trusting each other, inspiring each other, pushing everybody forward. And it's amazing, you know, maybe you can create another opera house. But I want to finish, Michelle, because the question in front of me said, what about me personally? So I want to finish with another story. That when I first came to Australia in 1986 and worked with John Nutt, who I referred to earlier, John had a boat called Come By Chance, which he had bought from the proceeds of winning the Sydney Opera House lottery, believe it or not. You know, the guy who'd helped design it then won it. I'm sure there was no connection at all between those two events. But I went sailing with him and he introduced me to the daughter of one of the architects, Bill Burrows, who'd worked with Halton and Littlemore, who is now my wife. So the Opera House means an awful lot to me in other ways as well.
Oh.
And we have to say also, because we're doing this podcast today, that it was on the number was 112, right? The number won the lottery was 112. And today that we're making this recording, it's 11123. And my second grandchild has been born on 11123.
And everything is connected. Look at that. So we are talking about legacy, future generations, and how the Opera House has connected love, life, and lasting memories. I cannot thank you both enough for joining me today, Louise, Tristram. It's been a true delight. Sadly, we have run out of time because I feel like we could do this for a whole day. But thank you again for joining me and sharing your insights.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Louise.
Thanks, Tristram.
There were so many great stories in that chat. I hope you found it as interesting as I did. While we covered so much history, I love how the power of partnership shone through to the future plans too. I believe that it's relationships like these that will help us to solve the most critical sustainable development challenges that we know we are facing. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave us a review and subscribe to Sustainable Forces on your favorite streaming service.